Since last week, I discovered I have the most tenuous of personal connections to Bishop Hensley Henson. I was talking to a former parishioner of my father's, who's now 92, and she revealed that in 1947, at Bishop Henson's death, she bought a glass-fronted cabinet from his house sale, which I've known since I was a boy. When they got it back to the house in 1947, they were discussing Bishop Henson, and the lady who did for them overheard them discussing Henson, said, "Oh, Henson, oh, I like him. He's a regular comic." She was confusing Bishop Henson with Leslie Henson, a well-known music hall comedian of the time, founder of ENTSA, the Army's Entertainment Corps, famous also for his bulging eyes. I suspect that Bishop Henson's dry humour would not have appealed to her in the same way. But to Thomas Cromwell, two sessions here on Cromwell and the monasteries. Thomas Cromwell, the defender of monasteries, is an unfamiliar figure. Yet during his travels for Cardinal Wolsey in dissolving monasteries for the two cardinal colleges, there are at least two examples of him saving monasteries from closure. In West Sussex in 1525, Cromwell gained permanent gratitude from a small Augustinian priory called Shoolbred. Now here, the threat didn't come from Wolsey's dissolution program, but from parallel moves by the energetic and independent-minded Bishop of Chichester, Robert Sherburne. Now, Sherburne was clearly trying to use surplus monastic revenues to finance the two cathedral prebends that he'd just founded at Chichester Cathedral. He got as far in 1525 as demolishing part of the church and the domestic buildings at Shoolbred, presumably to create a viable prebendal house on the site. But then desperate pleas from the monks to local gentry friends resulted in two of those Sussex gentlemen going up to Westminster and buttonholing Cromwell in Westminster Hall while he was transacting legal business. And on their suggestion, he lobbied the hereditary patron of Shoolbred Priory, the Earl of Northumberland. And as a result, Shoolbred Priory survived in its truncated premises, not greatly, I think, to the edification of the monastic life in England, but it survived into the late 1530s and gratefully voted its saviour an annuity. This was Cromwell's earliest pension from any monastery, no doubt an eye-opener to him as a possible source of income. And at the same time, Cromwell was involved in reprieving another, one of Wolsey's own intended dissolutions, another small Augustinian priory at Bilsington in Kent. Now, Bilsington perfectly illustrates how Cromwell used his connections of kin and locality, and they used him. From childhood on, he'd had very strong connections with the gentry of Kent. And in 1525, one of the chief men of Kent, Sir Henry Guildford, wrote to him about leasing Bilsington Priory from the Cardinal, since he understood that Cromwell was supervising its dissolution. But in fact, Bilsington remained undissolved for another decade. Now, it's difficult to see its escape as unconnected to the fact that its prior was from another Kentish gentry family who'd known Cromwell's family all his life, the St. Ledgers, or Sellingers. Prior Arthur Sellinger was brother to Anthony Sellinger, whose mid-Tudor career was made by Cromwell's patronage. Anthony Sellinger became perhaps the most successful Lord Deputy of Ireland in the whole Tudor age. And so Bilsington mysteriously survived. In 1528, the reprieved community granted Cardinal Wolsey the right to appoint a new prior for them, because Prior Sellinger had moved on to head a larger Augustinian house at Leeds Priory in Kent. Now, this house acted as chaplaincy to the neighbouring castle, Leeds Castle, home to Sir Henry Guildford. Altogether, therefore, a cosy set of arrangements. And we can pick up other long-term links arising out of Cromwell's work for Wolsey. Not surprising that he maintained a relationship with John Burton, the former prior of St. Fridaswise, Oxford, whose premises, of course, became Cardinal College, Oxford, now Christchurch. Cardinal College was at the centre, of, as we've already seen, of his concerns in Wolsey's legacy project. And Cromwell went on to do John Burton a lot of good. In April, May 1524, Wolsey's officials, headed by Cromwell, induced William Barton, the abbot of Osney, to resign to make way for Prior Burton from St. Fridaswides, because Prior Burton was now out of a job, thanks to the dissolution of his monastery. And the newly promoted Abbot Burton of Osney remained a regular correspondent, dinner guest of Cromwell's well into the 1530s, and made him High Steward of Osney Abbey as well. But more significantly, Cromwell became a welcome visitor in a widely dispersed range of monasteries beyond those in Wolsey's sites for dissolution. He seems to have taken on a general informal portfolio for monastic affairs. And some of these relationships beyond the portfolio must simply be because he was nearby in some capacity. So predictably, he took an interest in the affairs of his landlords, the London Austin friars. A Dominican friar called Richard Ingworth later became Cromwell's main agent in destroying all friaries in the kingdom in 1538-1539. But Ingworth dated their friendship to 1526, by which time he was probably already prior of the important Dominican friary at King's Langley in Hertfordshire. And King's Langley was close to Cardinal Wolsey's favourite country retreat, the Moor, as Ingworth reminded his patron in a letter of 1538. Other lasting monastic friendships of Cromwell's reflect Wolsey's nationwide interventions in the late 1520s generally as legate a latere. As late as 1538, Abbot Stonewell of the great Benedictine house of Pershaw in Worcestershire expected Cromwell not only to remember straight away that Wolsey had placed Stonewell at Pershaw in 1526 after removing an unsatisfactory predecessor, but also to know something of the priory over which Stonewell had previously presided and clearly much preferred. "I trust your lordship doth not forget now what I left when I came to this." Now, note that Stonewell did not even think it necessary to remind Cromwell of the name of the previous priory, Tynemouth, up north. Cromwell would remember. And Cromwell developed a special relationship with an equally venerable Benedictine house south of Pershaw, on the edge of the Cotswolds, Winchcombe Abbey. Now, this needs a little complicated explaining, I'm afraid, but once more, the cardinal is key to it all. Wolsey, in 1527, promoted Cromwell a little to be one of his council, and that resulted in a small widening of his duties. And one little chore arose because in 1528, Wolsey took on the wardship of the young heir of the late and extremely wealthy Sir William Compton. And the cardinal made Cromwell a chief administrator of Cromwell's property in wardship. Now, the connection with Winchcombe was that Sir William Compton had family connections there. His will showed a deep affection for Winchcombe Abbey, and he made the abbey custodian of a fund to deal with any disputes about his bequests. And from that time onward, Cromwell became a recipient of warm letters from the retired abbot of Winchcombe, Richard Kidderminster, one of the most outstanding, respected churchmen of his age. And as late as 1532 or 1533, the aged Kidderminster could still write to Cromwell, now counsellor to the king, to affirm, after many pious compliments, that I do daily hear of the increase of your honour and authority is more to my comfort in Jesu than I may express in writing. Others of a more, an equally traditional cast of mind and religion might not then have been so enthusiastic at Cromwell's rise into the king's favour. And Kidderminster's successor as abbot at Winchcombe was also a friendly correspondent, more than once expecting to see Cromwell at Winchcombe and saying with mild reproach in one letter that the abbey had thought to have entertained him over the Christmas season. Now, in forming friendships with such great figures of the Benedictine tradition, Cromwell was establishing links with English monasticism at its most scholarly and reform-minded. Winchcombe, the neighbouring Hales Abbey, Evesham Abbey, three neighbours in the Cotswolds, enjoyed a lively, interconnected intellectual life, fully aware of humanist advances in learning and also in close contact with the University of Oxford. This intimate relationship between Winchcombe Abbey and the King's chief minister persisted until its very late dissolution on the eve of Christmas 1539, and we'll glimpse this relationship again in the next lecture. One of the most charming examples of Cromwell's relationships with monasteries comes from the Augustinian Priory of Laund in Leicestershire, for which Cromwell did several favours during his Wolsey years. Thomas Frisby, a canon of Laund, wrote to Cromwell probably in 1531, presenting him with six cheeses and cheerfully reminding him of one of Cromwell's visits to the priory when they were out together walking home from a neighbouring village and Canon Frisby fell over on his back in the snow. After Cromwell's execution, Laund became the chief home and indeed burial place of Gregory Cromwell, Thomas Cromwell's son. Now, none of these letters from Winchcombe or Laund or anywhere else were written at a time when Cromwell was the all-powerful statesman to be flattered and placated, unlike the depressingly voluminous pile of sycophantic monastic correspondence from 1532 onwards. They all predate that. Altogether, Cromwell, in his travels around monasteries, gained an interest in and a countrywide knowledge of monastic life, which was very unusual among lay people in his day, and fatefully transformed with remarkable speed after he gained power under King Henry. This set of relationships reflected his anomalous place among Wolsey's servants dealing with church affairs. Most of them, as you'd expect, were clergy, but he was not, because of his specialist role in preparing the cardinal's plans for immortality in this world and the next. Remember the Italian craftsman and the tomb. And in the typical style of his improvisatory genius, Cromwell was to develop this anomaly when, as a layperson, he revived Wolsey's legatine powers in the name of the king in the 1530s. Eventually as royal vicegerent in spirituals. In the meantime, Wolsey had fallen from power, brought low by his inability to do something almost impossible, securing a papal annulment of Henry VIII's first marriage. His fall, his dismissal as Lord Chancellor, came in autumn 1529. And the king summoned a parliament, one of whose tasks might well have been finally to destroy Cardinal Wolsey. At the moment that the Cardinal left his Westminster Palace of York Place forever, Reginald Poole noted the widespread belief in London that Cromwell had been arrested for his part in the dissolution of monasteries and might well be executed. Evidently, monastic dissolution was what Cromwell was already known for. Instead, Cromwell secured himself a place in the House of Commons, in this parliament which Victorians christened the Reformation Parliament, for its unprecedented 6 years of existence and its part in transforming English religion. Cromwell became one of the burgesses for Taunton, one of the two MPs for Taunton, a Somerset borough with which he had no connection whatsoever, except that it was part of Wolsey's episcopal estate as Bishop of Winchester. Now, why was he elected to Taunton or Parliament at all? to save himself, perhaps, but more importantly, to save Wolsey. The cardinal would feel it vital to infiltrate representatives into the House of Commons, to have at least one or two voices to speak up for him against the weight of malice and propaganda. And we know that this is precisely what Cromwell did. Wolsey's biographer, George Cavendish, his servant as well, praised the Burgess for Taunton's courage, despite the fact that Cavendish was a religious conservative and could not have approved what happened next in Cromwell's career. He portrayed Cromwell repeatedly making incontinent replies to anything said against Wolsey, even speaking successfully against a bill to condemn him for treason. Now, to defend the cardinal in open parliament was a high-risk thing to do, but it got Cromwell noticed and might not necessarily be contrary to the unstable inclinations of King Henry VIII. Cavendish said that it made a good impression on people. And interestingly, he gets exactly contemporary support from an Essex parson who was a good friend of Cromwell and became one of his chaplains, Thomas Shiel. And he wrote during the Parliament itself that he had comfortable tidings that ye be in favour highly with the King's grace, Lord and commonalty, as well spiritual as temporal. And a century later, the historian Lord Herbert of Cherbury said something similar, which sounds actually like an echo of Cavendish. Upon this honest beginning, Cromwell obtained his first reputation. Not, one notes, a reputation as an evangelical hothead, but as judicious defender of the stricken cardinal against all comers, at a time when it was not necessarily in his own best interests, and when he was the public face of Wolsey's monastic dissolutions. Observers would and did decide whether this combination made him worthy of praise or hatred. And one other feature of this frustratingly ill-documented parliament is worth noting. The champion of conservative religion was Bishop John Fisher of Rochester. And he furiously denounced complaints against the clergy in the House of Commons and accused the Commons of heresy. A huge row followed, which drew in King Henry himself to intervene and force Fisher to make conciliatory noises towards the House of Commons. Now, modern historians have long doubted the authenticity of the text of Bishop Fisher's speech, which we have. It's only preserved in hagiographical sources, and it seems to contain one big anachronism: Fisher's emphasis on opposing proposed legislation to close smaller monasteries. Surely that notion belonged to 1536, by which time Fisher had been dispatched to sainthood by King Henry VIII. Henry's biographer, J.J. Scarisbrick, first championed the authenticity of this speech. I'm sure he is right. The only good reason for doubting the dissolution proposal is that no other source recorded it. Now, if the Commons were enraged at Fisher's accusations of heresy, one reason is that in 1529, there was nothing necessarily heretical about dissolving monasteries. For who then was the arch-dissolver of monasteries? No anti-clerical radical, but Cardinal Wolsey. The most recent of his suppressions took place only 7 months before the opening of Parliament, when on the 1st of April 1529, in the presence of Thomas Cromwell and Ralph Sadler, Dr. Rowland Lee took the surrender of the diminutive Augustinian Priory of St. Lawrence Mountjoy in North Norfolk to complete the endowment of Cardinal College Ipswich. Realistically, if any house deserved suppression as superfluous, it was Mountjoy. Cromwell's activity in Cardinal Wolsey's dissolution was the one thing most people knew about him, and most of them hated him for it. That curious pairing of Reginald Poole and John Fox agreed on that fact. Now, if Cromwell was involved in a new proposal for dissolution in that parliament, it would bridge the two matters currently on his mind: an attack on clerical wealth on the one hand, and the defence of Thomas Wolsey's proceedings on the other. Now, the suggestion that more monasteries be dissolved was a red rag to Bishop Fisher, but it would also have been of great interest and gratification to another keen observer of what was going on in Parliament, King Henry VIII. The reason given to justify a dissolution, according to Fisher's speech, was to recompense the king for his great expenses in seeking an annulment of his supposed marriage to Catherine of Aragon. There is much resonance for the future there. That winter, 1530, Cromwell entered a double service, both to monarch and cardinal. Wolsey was stripped of estates, but he still remained at large, soon exiled to York to take up his duties as Archbishop of York. Cromwell became, in effect, royal secretary for Wolsey-related affairs. Who better? He knew the estates, particularly the estates of the two colleges, and he did his best to save what he could from the wreck. At Oxford, famously, he succeeded. During 1531, he also moved into the position of parliamentary manager, which put him in charge of the task of securing ever greater powers for the monarchy in the church. And this parliamentary management was the basis of the rest of his career, his much expanded service to the king. But what is remarkable about Cromwell's service in the years of Anne Boleyn's ascendancy is how apparently trivial his promotions were. Remarkably, according to the imperial ambassador Chapuys, in 1531 his status as royal counsellor was concealed for 4 months while the 1531 parliament was in session. And more than anyone else, he put into place the break with Rome, the conditions for the Boleyn marriage. Yet during the reign of Queen Anne, he did not even receive a knighthood. And there was a huge irony in that, because at Anne's coronation in 1533, he was actually appointed as collector of the fines on those who refused knighthood on that occasion. Now, there is a pattern behind his non-appointments and relatively minor appointments between 1530 and 1534. The outward appearance clashed with the reality. The reality that Cromwell grew ever more important in government during those years. Even by early 1533, no one under the king could match him. And so Ambassador Chapuys repeatedly affirmed that he was the man enjoying most credit with the king. It's all more than an accident. It must represent deliberate choice. But whose? Most obviously, the king's. There were people at court who would have been furious at Cromwell's public promotion to honourable office. And they were headed by Anne Boleyn and her uncle, Thomas Howard, Duke of Norfolk, of whom we will hear much more. Now, Anne was no slouch when it came to the staging of screaming rows. Equally, King Henry was a thorough coward when it came to public confrontation. And it took time to maneuver his new minister into an unassailable public role. Most likely, Anne could only be persuaded to accept, with a good grace, something of the reality of Cromwell's position once he'd triumphantly steered her through to marriage and coronation. Meanwhile, right from his first clandestine appointment as councillor in early 1531, Cromwell had a major, unheralded portfolio, and one we've come to expect from Thomas Wolsey's sometime agent. Monasteries, including a small and tentative but unmistakable trial of further dissolutions. And this was part of a wider program of his in interfering in the internal affairs of the English Church. The extensive interference in monastic life, which he now resumed, is the most striking example of the way between 1530 and 1534 he was given a great many responsibilities without any formal royal title at all. The variety of ecclesiastical business on which he launched himself reproduces pretty completely what he would do with explicit formal legal authorization after 1534 as vicar general and vicegerent in spirituals. Now, this work seems to have started quite suddenly in December 1531, and thereafter it simply remained constant and frequent. It morphed seamlessly out of all he'd done over the previous year to expand the royal estate for new royal palaces. In particular, Wolsey's York Place became Whitehall, and north of Westminster, beyond it, came land purchases and exchanges. From then on, Cromwell's activity had all that later omnivorousness of the vicegerency in the church. Thus, on the 30th of December 1532, Sir Edward Guildford wrote from Kent, protesting at Cromwell's order to the trustees of a local chantry to dismiss its priest and replace him with someone whom Sir Edward considered thoroughly unsatisfactory. "They would have to talk about it when he came up to the next session of Parliament," he said crossly. Why, he might have asked, would Cromwell have involved himself in such a trivial ecclesiastical matter? Now, Guildford and Cromwell were friends, and Guildford was a familiar figure at court. But it's remarkable that the wider general public were also already aware of the minister's interest in church affairs. And moreover, the public knew him as the enemy of the traditional church hierarchy. That general impression gave a fine opportunity to three West Country wide boys to exploit the naivety of an aged Somerset priest entangled in a local dispute with them. In late September 1532, they staged a mock arrest on the priest, claiming a special commandment from Cromwell to bring him before the royal council. Their demands for money were accompanied by blood-curdling threats that if he knew how sore Master Cromwell was against priests and how grievously he handled them, he would rather spend all the goods he had than come before him, for Cromwell was a man without any conscience against priests. Well, it was January 1533 before this deception was found out, and the poor cleric got a chance to complain about it all, which is why we know about it, and Cromwell filed the complaints in his papers. Cromwell's interference in church affairs, nevertheless, was still led by his relations with monasteries, just as in the evolution, open evolution of the vicegerency a few years later. First, in December 1531, he steered through major exchanges of property between the Crown and three royal monasteries around London, Waltham Holy Cross, Westminster Abbey, and the Charterhouse at Sheen. And these were only part of a complex set of transactions, and the non-monastic elements don't seem to have concerned him at all. He is concerned with these monastic things. Straight away, however, he was doing far more than supervising land transactions and land business. Martin Heal has recently done a survey of Cromwell's correspondence at this time. He's found 150 or so exchanges of letters between Cromwell and the heads of religious houses between 1532-1534, so 3 years, 150 letters. Monastic heads regarded him as the best person to write to in time of trouble. So, in July 1532, the Abbot of Jervaux in Yorkshire wrote to him, despite being unacquainted, to stop the Bishop of London sending back a runaway monk expelled from Jervaux several years before. Cromwell routinely took the lead in settling the choice of monastic heads all over the country, for all the world as if he were Cardinal Legate like his old master. But now, on behalf of the king, actually, he was intervening far more frequently than Wolsey had the previous few years. One such case was Muchelney Abbey in Somerset. Now, the appointment of a new abbot for this ancient Benedictine foundation in 1532 was of an indecorously young monk in his early 20s, and it was effected with substantial money arriving informally in Cromwell's pocket. Now, this was not something that happened much in the later years of his ascendancy. Cromwell was offered many bribes in his career. If you follow up the result, you see that the bribe was either not taken or it did not have the consequences hoped for. It was a wasted investment. Cromwell's acceptance of the Muchelny bribe in 1532 was perhaps the result of overexcitement at his new power, or perhaps a reflection of the fact that at this early stage of his career in royal service, he only had minor formal office and modest estates. He was short of cash. Didn't last. Instead of bribes, already many monasteries, gentry and nobility, were setting him up with a regular fee, as one you would for a legal consultant, often with a formal grant of nominal office. And of course, presents were always acceptable. They oiled the wheels of early modern government in general, particularly if offered with a little self-deprecating joke. So Bishop West of Ely, we've heard of before, in March 1533, regretted that he could not do a requested favour that Cromwell wanted from him, but he sent Cromwell a poor token of St. Audrey. Audrey, or Etheldreda, was the patron saint of his cathedral, Ely, and from its proverbially downmarket fare, our word tawdry derives. I think it's unlikely that Bishop West's present was tawdry, anything from a gold coin to a pie. But what is missing, in general, from the evidence of Cromwell's finances is the huge bribe. That was not his style. In both monastic and general church business, Cromwell acted in concert with his great friend, Dr. Roland Lee, who I've just mentioned in passing, former colleague in dissolutions under Cardinal Wolsey. Dr. Lee was a Northumberland man with a Cambridge doctorate in canon law. Like Cromwell, he'd been loyal to their old master to the bitter end. And in the early 1530s, Lee's gruff fondness for little Gregory gave him a special place in the proud father's esteem. And Lee extended this avuncular interest to a variety of his own nephews and nieces, which suggests a man whose clerical vocation did not include much sympathy for the cloistered life. Indeed, Lee was not an especially clerical clergyman, which may have commended him to Thomas Cromwell. To his partnership with Cromwell, he bought an extensive northern gentry cousinage of Lees and others, many of whom proved their usefulness in various ways, not least because this was a part of the country that Cromwell didn't know. And here were people who were eyes and ears in that world. But now, in 1531-32, their old cooperation in matters ecclesiastical continued, extending royal control of the church in England at the same time as Cromwell pushed forward the same programme in Parliament. Cromwell had not as yet completed the powers which were going to be the vicegerency and once had been Wolsey's as papal legate. The cardinal had been able to override various English monastic jurisdictions, and on the eve of a major confrontation with the papacy, these now needed fresh attention, but this time for the king. The Cistercian order, for example, was part of an international corporation with its mother house in France, of course at Citeaux, and its current visitor was a Frenchman, the Abbot of Charlie. And in 1532, the king replaced the Abbot of Charlie with a wider commission of English Cistercian abbots. That had happened before, but the Royal Commission justified it now by saying that it was not convenient to admit a stranger into the realm. That was a full year before the break with Rome. Despite this provision, the new mood of 1532 was such that Cistercians or their patrons wanting to challenge abbots in royal commission turned to Cromwell rather than to the abbots. Witness the example of Gervaux I've already quoted you. Now the Premonstratensian order. Unlike the Cistercians, this order was an exempt jurisdiction which the crown could not override with the excuse of excluding a stranger from the realm, because very early in King Henry VIII's reign, the English Premonstratensians had patriotically secured exemption from their mother house in France, and they were therefore headed by the Abbot of Welbeck in Nottinghamshire. Nevertheless, it was to Cromwell that the Master of Christ's College, Cambridge, turned about a Premonstratensian abbatial election at Coverham in Yorkshire. The intermediary in this was Dr. Rowland Lee. Now, the Master of Christ's wanted to advance a monk who was a brother of a fellow of Christ's called Leonard Horseman. He was a Yorkshireman and himself already a client of Thomas Cromwell. Rowland Lee first approached Cromwell about Coverham in late 1531 or 32. And on that occasion, Cromwell backed off. He said he was distracted by manifold business. Clearly didn't want a confrontation with the Abbot of Welbeck at that stage. But a little later, one Roger Horseman duly got his promotion as Abbot of Coverham, for a while at least. Now, working towards that result, on New Year's Day, 1533, Dr. Lee made a shrewd effort to get Cromwell's interest focused back on Coverham, representing it as a troubled house in need of intervention. There be two things to be remembered. One, the reformation of such enormities. The second, the interest of the King, His Highness, being founder there, whereby in that religion and order of the Premonstratenses might something grow to the King's advantage, as in other orders. And that discreet father, the Abbot of Welbeck, as ye know, partly to be prevented from exercising his lordly jurisdiction. Lee thus alerted his friend to possibilities of neatly combining monastic reform with the clipping of monastic wings. And that was to be the hallmark of Cromwell's ecclesiastical policy over the next few years. Alongside all these transactions during 1532, Cromwell spearheaded what looks like, remarkably, an opportunistic program of specimen dissolution. Now, this clutch of suppressions followed the profile of Wolsey's programme exactly. One major monastery and satellite suppressions of little houses. The big one, in this case, was the prominent London Augustinian house of Holy Trinity or Christ Church, Aldgate, equivalent to St. Bridewide's Oxford in Wolsey's dissolutions, up near Liverpool Street Station today. Christchurch Aldgate, despite its stately church and honourable position in the City of London, was deep in long-term debt. And its suppression came first, and very suddenly, in late February 1532. Dr. Rowland Lee was in charge of proceedings, alongside another Cromwell client and canon lawyer, Dr. John Oliver, soon to be Dean of Wolsey's Old Oxford Foundation, now King Henry's College, Oxford. Now, a mark of the novelty of the action at Christchurch Aldgate was the government's clear uncertainty about what to do with its redundant assets. In various suppressions over the previous 150 years, monarchs or churchmen had redeployed the estates and buildings of dissolved monasteries for new uses within the church system, especially for chantry colleges, mostly at Oxford and Cambridge, Wolsey's being the last. Now, new chantries were not going to be founded in 1532, particularly if Cromwell had anything to do with it. One scheme was to make Christchurch Aldgate the basis for a new city hospital, but nothing came of that. There was even less substance to a rumour that the troublesome Greenwich Observant Franciscans would be moved to the empty buildings. But with their increasing opposition to the King's annulment plans, that wasn't going to happen either. Instead, the outcome at Christchurch anticipated the main programme of monastic suppressions. The beneficiary was a layman, Lord Chancellor Thomas Audley, gaining some of the income and property he felt appropriate to his office. Sadly, he did not cease to be preoccupied by that after Aldgate. Audley was a little uncertain of the proprieties in receiving this bonanza without exception. Exact precedent. He suggested to Cromwell that he would keep some liturgical use for the stately church. But that came to nothing after the neighbouring parish of St. Catherine Cree refused to move their worship there, worrying about how permanent their title might be. The London historian John Stowe reminisced with some satisfaction that Audley's subsequent demolition of the church had been badly botched. Dr. Roland Lee was doing other things at the same time, leading another team with a major ecclesiastical task, supervising on behalf of the king the Diocese of Coventry and Lichfield, which covered a vast area of the West Midlands and Northern Welsh borders. The aged Bishop of Coventry and Lichfield, Geoffrey Blythe, died sometime in late 1531. And this royal initiative is actually quite odd, because the administration of a vacant diocese was the prerogative of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And indeed, there is a mention of Archbishop Wareham's official stoically carrying on his conventional visitation of Coventry and Lichfield, sede vacante, alongside Lee's own activities. But Lee's group of royal administrators was appointed to deal with Bishop Blythe's temporalities, that is, his landed possessions as a subject of the crown. That was the king's right. But they interpreted that brief as generously as they could. Their actions blatantly marginalised Wareham's jurisdiction before any formal submission of the clergy to the king had taken place. Evidently, as was becoming Cromwell's custom, they were pushing their luck. Lee was actually nominated as Bishop of Coventry and Lichfield at this time. But remarkably, there was pushback. He did not get the office until 1534, and at the hands of a new Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer. Cromwell's team were clearly feeling their way at this stage and could be thwarted. But in one respect, they were not. A further monastic dissolution in the diocese. Dr. Lee's local team administrator was the Archdeacon of Salop, Richard Street. And on 6th of April 1532, Street reported to Lee the death of the prior of Callich, a small Augustinian priory in Staffordshire, very small, that left only one canon in occupation. Street's follow-up letter to Cromwell 3 weeks later reported that the house was now void and therefore escheated to the crown, was forfeit to the crown. Well, that was stretching a point given the actual continuing presence of the canon. But the following day, Street had an indenture drafted, granting Callich to a minor courtier and prominent local gentleman, Ralph Longford, who claimed to be founder. Well, this document was in fact a legal mess, ending up as a lease of Callich at an economic rent yet to be decided to Longford or anyone else whom the king chose. Inept or not, if operative, it removed the rights of any monastic founder other than the king. Now, this was a remarkable precedent. But even when Lee's team bothered to set up a formal inquisition to complete the settlement, that did not end the problems that the little monastery raised. More than a year later, Cromwell was still being dragged into irritable correspondence on competing claims at Callich. "I well perceive who granteth such men an inch, they will take an L," he snapped at Archdeacon Street. And what was going to happen to the remaining canon? He was still hanging around Callich when Cromwell wrote that letter to Street in June 1533. And Cromwell said he must be sent to some good house of that religion, being near unto you. Well, there didn't seem much else remaining of the godly and charitable purposes which the draft lease had mentioned that the king held towards this operation. Well, we have generous documentation on the Callich affair, but only one letter survives to illuminate the obscure end of another little Augustinian priory in North Wales at Bethgelert at precisely the same time. Now, the reason for Bethgelert's suppression is not at all clear. The local bishop was still in place, so there wasn't any local royal team at work. Perhaps they just heard about it via the North Wales grapevine. Beth Gellert may have simply ended up with no canons at all, and thus escheated the crown. But news of its fading reached as far as the household of the teenaged Princess Mary in Kent by the 30th of November 1532. Her leading servants, Margaret Countess of Salisbury and John Lord Hussey, wrote to Cromwell asking for a lease of the priory for one of the princess's footmen, for that ye have the letting thereof. Well, there was splendid irony here, as so often in the reign of Henry VIII. Both signatories of this letter to Cromwell, Salisbury and Hussey, were destined to die on the block for defending the world of monasteries and traditional religion. Yet the fact that they had no hesitation in approaching Cromwell is one little indication that Mary's household did not regard him as a hostile force at this stage, or later, as we will see next week. Now, the clinching proof of the link between Kalich and Beth Gellert is that Cromwell bundled their supervision into one administrative job, which he kept personally under his wing. And many people knew this. So the Anglesey magnate, Sir Richard Bulkeley, riskily presented him with a fait accompli, sending his brother to occupy the tenancy of Beth Gellert, relying on a previous face-to-face promise from Cromwell. Well, this chutzpah, unsurprisingly, did not produce a long-term lease for the Bulkeleys, because soon Dominican Friar Provincial John Hilsey was after Beth Gellert as well, for a Welsh protégé from his order studying here in Oxford. Hilsey added diplomatically that Friar Griffith would have made friends to the king's grace for the gift of the same, unless I commanded him to the contrary, for to avoid and escape your mastership's displeasure. It was no doubt with relief that in 1535, Cromwell formally handed over this tedious little task to John Gostwick. Gostwick was a gourmet of financial trivia, as well as another former servant of Wolsey's. And there's a possibility that a fourth monastery escaped these experiments in dissolution by the skin of its teeth, thanks to some second thoughts from Cromwell. Another little Augustinian house in Sussex, a place called Hardham. Bishop Sherburn of Chichester said gratefully around this time that by Cromwell's prudent counsel and charitable words, the priory of Hardham, the which was decreed to have been suppressed, standeth and prospereth. Well, in fact, it did get dissolved 2 or 3 years later in a notably obscure fashion, closely connected to Cromwell's household. Now, there are clear common threads in these dissolutions or near dissolutions of 1532. All of them concerned Augustinian houses. A problem for the Austin canons was the very flexibility, brevity of their rule. And what had been an asset in the 12th century glory days of their foundations was now their weakness, an excess of small institutions languishing both economically and in spiritual morale. Otherwise, all four cases were notable for the extreme untidiness of what happened to the assets of the unfortunate monasteries, but for a general drift towards them ending in the hands of lay people. And this latter result was a complete innovation in late medieval English monasticism. It had last happened in the Anglo-Saxon period, but now it was to be the dominant motif in King Henry's dissolutions. From the late 15th century, there had been a new attitude towards struggling monasteries, best exemplified in that unsentimental monarch, King Henry VII. Between 1494 and 1507, Henry VII likewise dissolved four semi-derelict monasteries for his own benefit. And although some of that benefit was for the wealth of his soul, material wealth also entered into it, because he extracted a tidy sum in three suppressions from the religious institutions to whom he granted their estates. Yet still, the end result was a redistribution for spiritual and educative purposes, just like Wolsey's suppressions. Now, in 1532, the rules had not simply broken down, they were being rewritten on a large scale, and their remaining monks dealt with. There needed to be a system in place for those monks to be processed away from their former monasteries. It would not do to take up Cromwell's valuable time. All this was a lesson learned. The consequence in 1536 was the Court of Augmentations. It's not actually a new idea that these dissolutions of 1532 were a test of public reaction. That shrewd 17th century commentator Thomas Fuller looked back to the end of Christchurch Aldgate, and he noted wryly that some conjecture this was King Henry's design to make a discovery in people's affections, how they resented the same. He dispatched this convent first, and if he had found the people much startled thereat, he could quickly knock off, retrench his resolutions, and, dexterous to decline envy for himself, handsomely cast the same on his instruments employed therein. That brilliantly nails King Henry's devious sense of self-preservation. Well, there is a festive tailpiece to all these monastic adventures in 1532. Our last journey takes us to Cambridge and then on to Norfolk. Remember that slew of exchanges of land in 1531, consolidating King Henry's royal estates around London. One such exchange was between the Crown and Christ's College, Cambridge. In return for a college manor in Essex, the King granted Christ's College, Cambridge, yet another small dissolved Augustinian priory, Broomhill, up in Norfolk Breckland. It was then some 3 years since the affairs of Broomhill Priory were wound up for Cardinal Wolsey, the agents being Stephen Gardiner, Roland Lee, Thomas Rush, and Thomas Cromwell. So our tale links these earlier dissolutions to the fresh crop in 1532. Now, this deal is interesting because it's the only one in the whole batch of royal exchanges to do with an Oxbridge college. Maybe Christ's wanted Broomhill as a sort of summer retreat, plague house, which was exactly what Pofley Priory, remember Pofley Priory, that had been exactly that for Cardinal College, Oxford. So perhaps that's what they wanted. Both little priories are about the same distance from their parent college. But that's not how it turned out. In June 1532, no less a person than Roland Lee intervened, drafting a letter in his own hand for Cromwell to send to the master. It arranged for the college to grant a 60-year lease of the priory to a certain Roger Fowler. Now, Fowler was Lee's brother-in-law. And this was only one element in a sudden tangle of associations between Cromwell, Lee, and Christ's College, Cambridge. At the heart of it all was the education of little Gregory Cromwell, who had transferred from tuition at Pembroke Hall, Cambridge, to Christ's just at this time. Gregory's schooling had long been contentious, but in the charge of a self-willed and powerful nun, Margaret Vernon, prioress of Little Marlow. But by 1532, Prioress Vernon was looking after his education in amicable cooperation with the Master of Christ College, Cambridge, Henry Lockwood. And Lockwood wrote from a visit to Marlow, reporting Gregory as merry. And it must be said that this is the first phase of Gregory's schooling which didn't involve some sort of row or contention. Cromwell was clearly pleased, and he offered Henry Lockwood the rich London benefice of St. Sepulchre's Holborn in summer 1532. though in the end it was agreed that Roland Lee would have it instead. Dr. Lee was now very much honorary uncle to Gregory Cromwell. At the end of Michaelmas term 1532, Dr. Lee cheerfully set out for Norfolk from his Essex parsonage of Ashton with your little man, Gregory, not only well and cleanly kept, but also profits in his learning. They were off to spend the holiday over Christmas and New Year into 1533 at Broomhill Priory with some of Gregory's young friends from Cambridge, hosted by Master and Mistress Fowler. On New Year's Day, 1533, Dr. Lee wrote to Cromwell at Broomhill, among a husfill of children, God help, he moaned in mock weariness. Surrounding Lee would be a bustle of little Gregory and his Cambridge friends and relatives, let alone any small Fowlers. It was a decade or two before most clergy of the English Church grew accustomed to such an experience. And so, with the rector of Ashton and his sister and brother-in-law enjoying family festivities where once Augustinian canons had meditated, and the shouts of overexcited early teenagers echoing round derelict monastic chambers in a Breckland winter, an old order gave place to the new world which Thomas Cromwell was now steering into existence.